This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 21st, 2004. Thirty-six years ago, Martin Luther King Jr. summoned working people across America to a Poor People's March on Washington to inaugurate a war on poverty at home. The United States government, he proclaimed, is one of the greatest purveyors of violence in the world. America is at a crossroads in history, and it is critically important for us as a nation and society to choose a new path and move on it with resolution and courage. The crisis facing working people today is even more acute than when Martin Luther King spoke those words. Under the cover of systematic lies and deception, wars of devastation have been launched at the expense of working people everywhere. In our name, a handful of the rich and powerful corporations have usurped our government. A corporate and banking oligarchy changes hats and occupies public office to wage class war on working people. They have captured the state in their own interests. On October 17th, workers, young and old, organized and unorganized, employed and unemployed, are mobilizing in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial for a vast fight back. The mobilization has begun. Today, on Taking Aim, the Million Worker March, a discussion with Ralph Schoenman, myself, Maya Schoen, and with Brenda Stokely, President of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, that's AFSCME, District Council 1707 in New York City. Ralph?
Brenda Stokely is a legendary figure in the labor movement in New York. At the press conference of the National Press Club, which took place on September 16th in Washington, I referred to her as our own Sojourner Truth, our Mother Courage. Brenda has been in charge of social services and human services and daycare workers with District Council 1707. Welcome, Brenda, to Taking Aim.
Hi, Maya and Ralph. I'm glad to be here. And I think the issue that we're discussing today is very important to the majority of the people in this country.
Let me mention that Brenda is the co-convener and organizer for the Million Worker March in New York. And Brenda, would you give us a sense of what you have experienced in reaching out to working people, those who are oppressed?
We found tremendous support. The support that not just saying, I'm going to endorse or I think this is a good idea, but the kind of support that only great movements are built by. People taking ownership of this march and volunteering to reach out to their friends, their relatives, their constituents in the organizations that they belong to. The activists in the unions have jumped on board, and most activists in the unions are also activists we find in their own communities, in their faith-based organizations, among youth, among the elderly. So those are their constituents, is a broad constituency that they're relating to. So that's the kind of help that we've seen, because people see that this is a long overdue expression of workers' power. Just the other night, we were postering on the African-American parade route, and we ran into a retired African-American male firefighter who said to us, can I have one of these? He said, because this is exactly what we need. And this is without us expressing verbally to them what our demands are, what the mission statement is. And then he said to me, it's too bad that labor didn't do anything during the Republican convention. And sad to say, labor did do something on September the 1st. There was very little publicity from the bourgeois press, but also apparently workers who were activists didn't know about it if they were retirees or they didn't get the word about it. So they see this march as being a manifestation of what is needed to try to turn this country around.
Well, you know, Brenda, just recently the Detroit Economic Club hosted John Kerry, in fact, on the 17th of September, where he presented himself as a spokesperson for U.S. corporations and bankers. And he stood next to Robert Rubin, also a multimillionaire, who was the Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton and is now holding the top post in the banking giant Citigroup. And in this presentation, Kerry stated, "My plan is not a government plan. It's based on incentives and the marketplace." And he assured that the corporations would enjoy greater tax benefits than they did under the previous administration. It's a rather extraordinary address that he gave, and he amplified it on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal in a column called My Economic Policy. And he said, "As I travel across the country, I meet store owners and stock traders and optimistic entrepreneurs. And their experiences are such that I want to state that I have business leaders like Warren Buffett, Lee Iacocca, and Robert Rubin who are joining my campaign because they believe that American business will do better." And he said, "What we need to do is change our CEO. And then he said, "The November 2nd election is in essence a, quote, national shock shareholders meeting, unquote." What does that offer working people?
I think it should be very clear to everybody that I think the mark of maturity, whether it's an individual or a movement, is when people recognize, an individual or a movement recognizes what their agenda is, and they recognize what they have to do to achieve that agenda. And I think that working people need to understand that they cannot hitch their wagon to a class of people who do not live like they live, who do not have the daily kinds of issues and concerns that they have, and who, quite frankly, are tied to people and wedded to people whose interest is just diametrically opposite of what working people need. So Kerry is making to me, I mean, you don't have to guess what he's saying. He's making it very clear. So for someone who's going to vote in November, they have two people of the ruling class to choose from, and no one to choose from that really is a champion of the agenda for the majority of the people in this country and in the world, who are people who work and toil, people who have to make difficult decisions about whether or not they're going to pay for a prescription or whether or not they're going to buy food, people who have to decide how their children are going to get to college and how they're going to pay for that, people who have to decide whether or not they're going to be able to pay their rent or their mortgage or lose their home or lose their apartment and be evicted, people who are being cast out of their jobs and on unemployment, and the unemployment runs out. Clearly, Kerry nor Bush seem to have any understanding of that. But not only him, look at Bloomberg right here in New York City. Some people voted for Bloomberg because they said he's a businessman and he'll run the city better. Yes, he's run the city right down into a deeper hole and turned his back completely on working people, has showed utter contempt for people who work, and is trying to run the city as a CEO where he's not accountable to anybody. He can make unilateral decisions, dictatorial decisions, without taking into account anyone else other than his own mind and what he thinks needs to be done. So I think that that's very telling and very sad, what Kerry said. And it's even sadder because many major labor organizations have invested working people's money, which is their dues money, and other monies that have been raised through their PAC programs. They're wedded to giving this money and giving energy and time of our staff to someone who would stand up in a meeting and say something like this is outrageous.
You spoke of health care, for instance, and recently there were some shocking statistics, not shocking to those of us like you and Ralph and myself who are dealing with these issues day in and day out, but shocking to most readers of the newspapers who then responded to these facts. 82 million people in the United States went without health insurance at some point in the past 2 years. 82 million people means one-third of the U.S. population. 45 million people are uninsured today. And of those, 7 million are here in California, which is one-fifth of the California population. In fact, 39 million people, or 14% of the U.S. population, go without or delay medical care, and for many of them, the cost of that medical care means bankruptcy. So we have here a critical issue for the American population, and yet what does the government do? Recently, for the elderly, many of whom are on fixed income, some who rely solely upon Social Security and receive barely $900 a month, they raise the cost of the Medicare premiums by 17%, and we're told this is just the beginning. In fact, as we, the baby boomers, are forced to rely upon Medicare and Social Security, as we come of age, after all, these are Medicare and Social Security are funds that are paid with our taxes that are withdrawn from our wages. When the time comes for the baby boomers, the expectation is that Social Security system and the Medicare system will be on the verge of bankruptcy. And unless there are vast new taxes, of which the 17% is just a minor increase, they're talking about 35 and 45% increases, if and even those may not be enough. Any form of Medicare and Social Security may be dropped. So these are real factors that go into the mobilization of the Million Worker March. There is no time to wait. And that is why people such as you, Brenda, are doing so much organizing. And this Friday, I understand, there's going to be a special event in New York, and I'd like you to tell our Taking Aim listeners about it. In fact, Ralph is coming from California and is one of the speakers, and I understand Danny Glover is also going to be there. But could you tell us something about this Friday, September 24th?
On Friday the 24th, between 6 and 9 p.m., we're holding, we meaning the New York City organizers for the Million Worker March, that includes Chris Silvera, who is with the Teamsters Local 808. He and I have responsibility for this area, and we have organized a fundraiser to try to contribute to the expenses that we have for this march. So we're inviting everyone to come out. The tickets are only $15. Danny Glover is coming. We've invited Chuck D, Amiri Baraka. Many local cultural activists are going to be involved, Nana Soul, and some young people that call themselves activists in action. They're going to be part of it. We're going to have a reggae singer from 1199. And we're going to have some community people giving solidarity statements. Clarence Thomas, who's one of the co-organizers from San Francisco, will also be accompanying Ralph Showman to the program. We hope to have solidarity statements from many of the union leaders in the community groups and youth who have helped us build up for this fundraiser and for the march. It will be at SEIU 32BJ, which represents the maintenance, janitors, doormen in both the residential and the commercial buildings in New York City who has the capacity every time they come to their contract negotiations to literally shut the city down. So they're being very kind and generous to allow us to use their space. Again, the address is 101 Avenue of Americas. That's one block from Canal in Manhattan, off of Grand Street. It's on the ground floor. The tickets are $15. That includes food, drink, great company, wonderful spiritual and political nourishment from our cultural activists, and some wonderful words of encouragement and political inspiration from those who have been involved in the organizing around this. So we invite everybody to come out to that.
And what time does it start?
It starts at 6 p.m. and it goes till 9 p.m. And again, it's at 32BJ at 101 Avenue of Americas this Friday, the 24th.
Well, Brenda, you know, the president of the American Postal Workers Union, William Burris, sent us a letter in which he stated that not only was his union endorsing, as indeed it did at its national convention, but that he was taking responsibility for organizing 1,350 chapters in over 50 states of the American Postal Workers Union to mobilize their 330,000 membership to take part in the Million Worker March. And we've had this happen from trade unions and social activist organizations in the anti-war movement, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, the Teamsters National Black Caucus, immigrant rights organizations, the anti-war movement from IAC to ANSWER to United for Peace and Justice. You've played a critical part in enlisting those trade unions and mass movements in support of the Million Worker March. Would you describe two things, Brenda? First, the nature of our demands, the axis around which this mobilization has been prepared, and the vision forward after this great mobilization at the Lincoln Memorial.
Well, as Maya said, health care is one of the centerpieces, the right to a job with a living wage, the issue of the war. All of these are issues that are not just intellectual issues. They're life and death issues. Because if someone cannot get access to quality and timely health care, if someone cannot get the proper treatment, whether it's prescriptions or any other form of treatment in a timely fashion, that person is bound to die an early death. If someone's child goes off to Iraq or Afghanistan or any other place in the war, they're bound to be injured either mentally or physically or to come back in a body bag. If someone loses their job and cannot find another job to feed themselves and winds up in a shelter, just this past Sunday we were distributing at the African American Day Parade, and a sister came up who told me she's been living in a shelter for 2 years. And she took our literature and she said, I'm going to take it back to my shelter, and I usually go in the community and find out what things are going on to bring back to the shelter so people are not so demoralized. She said, I'm going to take this back because this has to inspire people whether we can get there or not. And excuse me, on the spot, we made a commitment that we were going to try to get them there. Excuse me. So these are life and death issues, and I think it offers a space for people who are part of the organized labor and people who are not part of the organized labor to really truly have their issues heard and the seriousness of their issues. We're not a special interest group to be ignored. We are the life and blood of this society. We built the society. We keep it going. We nurture people's children. We take care of the elderly. We get people transported from one place to the other. We build housing. So this is really like the film, The Soil of the Earth. That's who this march is for. That's who needs to be there. And we're not going to just be rallying at Lincoln Memorial. We're also going to have organizing tents around these various issues so that people can come together who are doing work on the ground and new people who might not be plugged into some of these activities to join hands, come up with strategies and ideas or campaigns and take them back to their respective homes and be able to continue the work so that we can build a powerful social movement that is fundamentally going to change this country and make it be what it has to be.
Brenda, in And people in New York want to become involved with the organizing for the Million Worker March, or if they want to arrange to get on a bus, what telephone number, who do they contact in New York?
Well, there's two things. One, this Thursday, September the 23rd, at 6:30 p.m., there's going to be our six or seven, I think it's our six organizing meeting in New York City. It will be at my union headquarters, District Council 1707, which is located at 75 Varick Street, and that's off of Canal on the 14th floor in Suite 1404. The phone number where you can reach myself or Chuck Mohan, which is a staff person who's helping us with this, is area code 212-219-0022, extension 5185 or 5119. Also, you can reach out to Chris Severa, who is the Secretary Treasurer of Local 808, the Teamsters in Long Island. We've also met at his location. And his phone number is 718-389-1900, extension 21. So you can call any one of those numbers. You can also come to the organizing meeting. It's open to everyone. And you can come to the fundraising on the 24th to get information to buy tickets for the bus. What's happening now is that many organizations are getting their own buses. We're getting buses for each borough, our district council. The TWU transit workers are getting buses. DC 37, that represents all the municipal employees, are getting buses. 1199 has endorsed. We need to get back to Dennis Rivera and speak to him about what their ability is to get buses, but they usually contribute buses to these types of efforts. The Teamsters Local 808 are getting buses, but also I understand that at the Teamsters Black Caucus Convention that there was a commitment to get buses along the Eastern Seaboard. So there are going to be plenty of buses. Some of the community groups are getting buses. We've gotten calls from some of the elected officials. And we represent the daycare workers here in New York City. And we've gotten calls from daycare directors who want to get buses, in addition to the ones that we're getting, to help facilitate that parents and children and their staff gets to Washington. So we are hoping that there's going to be a whole caravan of buses leaving the New York area on its way down to Washington, D.C. on the 17th.
And for more information, in case you've missed the telephone numbers, which we'll repeat later on in the show, you can go to the Million Worker March website, which is www.millionworkermarch.org. And there's also another good website, and that's antiwar4millionworkermarch.org. And at that, there's a complete list of organizing centers throughout the country. And it's amazing, whether it's Massachusetts, Ohio, North Carolina, Oregon, California, Pennsylvania, or Rhode Island, there are people organizing to build the Million Worker March. Ralph?
Well, you know, Sal Roselli, who is the president of Local 250 of the SEIU Healthcare Workers, wrote an article called How Healthy is Labor Today? And he cited the Towers Perrin survey that found that 75% of businesses nationally have increased their deductibles and their co-payments and monthly contributions by workers in the past 2 years. In fact, there have risen health, the cost of workers for their own health care has risen by 70% in the past three years, and the same study found that 81% of employers are planning to increase employees' contributions dramatically to the point where health care is virtually unavailable to working families. 80% are without health insurance for working families that covers their most basic needs. And while that's happening, according to the Los Angeles Times, companies are avoiding taxes. 71% of foreign corporations pay no federal income tax, and those are essentially U.S. corporations that simply keep a phony office overseas. While 61% of American corporations altogether pay no income tax at all. And I just want to take a brief moment to look at what it was like under the Clinton administration, because every 4 years we are treated to the expectation that the evil lesser will present a challenge to the crisis facing working people. But during the Clinton years, and specifically in 1998, the conservative Cato Institute calculated that in every sector of the economy, the great corporations were subsidized by the federal government. 125 programs for the largest corporations at a net of over $200 billion a year, not including tax breaks. The top 17 corporations under Clinton paid no federal income tax over a period dating back 10 years. In agriculture, the agro-conglomerates received a $30.3 billion in government subsidy and $3 billion in rebates. The energy corporations were subsidized to the tune of $15.3 billion. The transportation conglomerates received a subsidy of $30.6 billion. Aerospace and high tech got $16.6 billion in subsidy. The major corporations in construction received $17.4 billion in subsidy. The financial services, the banks and the brokerage houses and the great centers of stock and bond speculation got $42.3 billion, and with tax breaks of $60.4 billion and commodity credit subsidies were $9.81 billion. Now, these were handouts to the corporate oligarchy. And let's just take a brief look at what that meant for working people. 60 cents of every tax dollar went to the Pentagon and less than a dime to health care. 3 cents were allocated to housing, and much of that for the affluent. 2 cents went to education, and most of that channeled to the schools of the rich. And 1% was allocated to generate employment. And during those Clinton years, a child died of poverty every 50 minutes in the United States, and hundreds of thousands of children were homeless each night, and 1 in 5 children went to bed hungry and cold, without heat, without running water, and without electricity. That's during the Clinton years. And now we're told that Medicare premiums are going to jump 17%, and that health care is disappearing for the American population. So therefore, what we say, and what I'd like you to address, Brenda, is this crisis and how we meet it and who speaks for us and how we take charge and take responsibility for bringing fundamental change in this society.
I think that, those statistics that you put out there are just... It paints the whole picture in terms of what the priorities are and whose interests every policy, every piece of legislation, every decision about what happens with the money that is raised and who gets welfare and who doesn't get welfare, because nobody who's getting public assistance could ever say that they've gotten anywhere near what the corporations have gotten. No one can say that the portion of taxes taken out of their paycheck is anywhere near someone not paying anything at all for taxes who can well afford to pay taxes. And by not having sufficient resources put into the coffers of our United States Treasury, then it limits the ability in terms of being able to provide the services. But then on top of that situation, you have what money there is going back to the same corporations that are being able to not pay any taxes or pay very little taxes. So I really, based on that whole situation, that's not a new situation. It's not something that just happened. It's not something that just happened under the Democratic or Republican Party. If you want to go back to the beginning of this country, I mean, it was built by fairly very wealthy people who, again, created a government, created policies, created legislation, made decisions that were going to enhance their situation at the demise of other people. So for those people who are saying to us, this is not the right time, workers wait. That's the same thing that African Americans that were told are doing slavery, that Native Americans were told, just sign one more treaty and just wait. That's what workers were told when they try to organize a new workplace, even today. We mistreated you, but now that you want to organize, we suggested you just wait because things are going to get better. And the only thing that happens when you wait is that you become more vulnerable, more disorganized and unorganized, and they are able, meaning the people who are now in power, they're able to continue their agenda, and you're disorganized, and you cannot be able to organize and fight for your own agenda. So we say we're not waiting, and we're not going to wait 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 hours, or 2 days for you to put somebody who's wealthy who doesn't have our agenda into place, and we're not going to be allowed to speak for ourselves. We think that this is the right time. As a matter of fact, it's probably long overdue that such a march should have occurred, and that's the kind of response that we're getting from people in the community. Our children are coming back in body bags. Not Bush's children, not Kerry's children, not any of the wealthy people's children, because they're not in the Army. They're not forced to make that sad choice of, let me go into the Army or to the Air Force or the Marines because I can't afford to get health care. I cannot find a job. I'm not getting training. As a matter of fact, I might not even have any place to live. And so my only choice to get 3 square meals, to get clothing, to get health care, and to get training is to go and kill somebody else. So we cannot wait another moment. We want our children brought home immediately, now. We don't want to wait for them to come home. We want health care now. We have the capacity. We're the only industrial country in the entire world that has not establish a national healthcare system here. We have the capacity, the money, the technology. We just don't have the will, because the people who are wealthy already have healthcare, and they don't care whether or not you die or you're in a vulnerable situation. There is more work in this world. There's no reason in this country why anybody should be unemployed. We need housing built. We need roads repaved. We need public transportation. We need hospitals. I could go on and on and on. Every day you can walk down the street and find a job that needs to be done, or go into a building and see a job. So there's no reason for anybody to be unemployed, except that it makes working people vulnerable so they can be further exploited if there's a pool of unemployed people and displaced workers. So this is the time. This is the time that we have to get back to what we're doing. Nothing has been won in this country unless there's been a big, heroic social movement where people were inspired that they have the right to fight back and their agenda is important. If I could just add one point, Martin Luther King, I was looking in a document that I had, and this was an address to the AFL-CIO convention in December 1961, where he said, "Negroes are almost entirely a working people. There are pitifully few Negro millionaires and few Negro employers. Our needs are identical with labor needs: decent wages, fair working conditions, livable housing, old age security, health and welfare measures, conditions in which families can grow, have education for their children, and respected in their community. That is why Negroes support labor's demands and fight laws which curb labor. That is why the labor hater and the labor baiter is virtually always a twin-headed creature spewing anti-Negro epithets from one mouth and anti-labor propaganda from the other mouth." This was in 1961. Now, those words ring true now, and it's not just for African Americans, as we're now calling ourselves, but it's also for the immigrant workers, for the Hispanic, Latino workers. It's for Asian workers. It's for poor white workers or displaced, the Appalachian people living in abject poverty. It's for everybody here who cannot find their way out of the agenda of this society today and this government today, which is basically saying you're despised, you're discarded, we don't need you except for when we're going to exploit you, and your agenda has no relevance to us today.
Okay, we'll be back after this station identification.
Malachi McCourt, and this is WBAI listener-sponsored radio in New York City.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. And today we're speaking with Brenda Stokely, president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees District Council 1707 in New York, about the vast mobilization to occur October 17th at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., the Million Worker March.
You know, Brenda, your eloquent presentation of what is in fact the fate of working people in the hands of the tiny oligarchy that has control of our society, including its political process, is illuminated and emphasized, I think, by a special report that was done in Business Week on April 20th, 1998. Richard L. Scott of Columbia HCA received $265.5 million in 1 year. Peter Nicholson of Boston Scientific Corporation got $231.1 million. David Jones of Humana, Inc. received $194.4 million. Leon Hirsch of U.S. Surgical Company was paid $105.8 million. That was just the salary. Leonard Abramson of United States Healthcare received stock options of $11.4 million and outright stock holdings of $783.9 million. His total compensation package was $805,122,145. Now, these payments were across the board among corporate conglomerates, as documented by Business Week on Clinton's watch in 1998. And now, in 2004, here's the New York Times on September 5th. Always on the job, employees pay with their health. American workers are stressed out in an unforgiving common economy and becoming more so every minute of every day. 62% have had their workload increased over the last 6 months. 53% have had their work leaves removed, and they are overtired and overwhelmed. Decades of research have linked stress to everything from heart attacks and stroke to diabetes and a weakened immune system, the article continues. And now researchers are connecting the dots, and they find that the stress, the uncertainty, have had a dramatic and devastating impact on workers' health and, by extension, to the survival of their families. It's a detailed article, it's a 12-page article, and it is an incredible indictment of the society that discards as human waste the great overwhelming majority of working people. This march, this mobilization, is addressing this crisis, is addressing this terminal condition in which a system is incapable of meeting the most elementary needs of human beings. And I would like, Brenda, if you would, to discuss the overall ambition of the march and mobilization to open the way for a new transformation and a new movement and a new agenda in this society for working people.
As we've all said, as we travel across the country, and we're saying it based on our observation of the kind of support and the responses we get from people, that it is definitely opening a space for people to raise up their concerns about how things are, what the status quo is, whether the status quo is in our government or the status quo within organized labor or the status quo in terms of municipal governments or in our communities. People are fed up and they're tired of the status quo. They're tired of the remedies that people give about how they're going to correct things when it's only they're giving those remedies so they could get into office. So people are at a point now that they, of course, are the ones who are feeling the crisis. They don't need anyone to tell them that they're in crisis because they're living it every day. What they need to hear is, do we have enough people in this country that believe that there needs to be a change, and they're going to work together to see that that change takes place? And people are being inspired by the fact that, yes, the answer is yes. There are people all across the country who are going to be who are participating and organizing for this march, who are going to be at the Lincoln Memorial, who are going to do work in terms of organizing when they leave there. And that is what is providing hope for people, that they have the ability, along with others, to make a change. So those organizing tents are very important, because that's where people are going to make their connection to go back and actually do work. Some people are telling me we're going to have a teach-in. Some people said we're going to talk about the campaigns that we want to do when we go back and for example, around housing issues. Some people are connecting internationally with other people that have like concerns, whether it's around women's issues or immigrants' rights or support of liberation struggles across the country or against the war, which is taking an international phenomenon in terms of anti-war a movement building. And so we hope that everyone who can make it there, even if you don't get on a bus, if you take a train, a car, or whatever, that you be there to stand in solidarity with your other sisters and brothers.
I'd like to talk about the success, the persistence, and effectiveness that our mobilizing can have. On September 16th, a few days ago, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee announced the signing of an agreement between FLOC, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, which represents farm laborers in the Midwest and in parts of the South, the North Carolina Growers Association, and the Mount Olive Pickle Company. It has been a five-year struggle of organizing, discussions with workers, and negotiations, and an immense boycott of Mount Olive Pickles. And I'd like to talk about this in particular, Valdemar Velasquez, an incredible organizer and a valiant fighter for justice, is one of the primary endorsers of the Million Worker March, and FLOC also participating. And what's amazing about this struggle, this five-year struggle, and it follows upon a long struggle of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee against the Campbell's Company and tomato growers in Ohio and the region surrounding Ohio, is that the workers involved are Mexican immigrants with H-2A visas. In other words, they are tied to the employer. And if they speak out, they lose their ability to work in the United States and are immediately deported. And if in this sector of worker, those with H-2A visas, those without rights, if you can persist and you join with labor and church and community organizations, and you can find victory, most definitely through mobilization like the Million Worker March, we can produce change and vast change. It is that persistence. It is having the goal. It is understanding the demands and understanding your opposition that makes the difference. Brenda, could you describe again the event that's taking place this Friday night? Because we need a very large turnout. And each and every one of you who comes to the event becomes, in effect, an organizer and builds the Million Worker March. So this becomes a vast mobilization and a kickoff for further mobilizations and further development of organization and the strengthening of our existing organization.
Thank you very much, Maya. This Friday, September the 24th, at 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., the New York City Organizing Committee is hosting a fundraiser and kickoff rally, or pep rally, for the Million Worker March. It will be held at SEIU, Service Employees International Union, headquarters 32BJ at 101 Avenue of Americas, and that's one block from Canal, and it's between Grand and Watt Street in Manhattan. The tickets are $15. You can get tickets at the door, or you can call 212-219-0022, extension 5185 or 5119, and put your name on a list for tickets or come down and purchase tickets. You can also call Chris Severa, local 808 International Brotherhood of the Teamsters, and his phone number is 718-389-1900, extension 21. Again, it's very, I think about myself when I was in San Francisco for a conference. I was fortunate enough to come to the kickoff rally at the International Longshoremen and Warehouse Workers Local 10's headquarters, and that inspired me to make a donation and to come back and help organize. I was very impressed with all of the assemblage of different union leaders and also community people and their commitment and belief in this campaign and this effort, and it inspired me to come back and organize. So we hope that our fundraiser would do the same. We also hope that you will come to our organizing meeting, which is the night before, which is Thursday, September the 23rd at 6:30 at our union headquarters, District Council 1707, and that's 75 Varick Street in Suite 1404, and that's one block from Canal.
Sorry. Many of you call us and write to us and say and ask, when is Ralph or when am I coming to New York? Well, this is your opportunity to see Ralph. He is going to be at the event on Friday, and most of all, you're going to have Brenda and Chris, Claren Thomas of the ILWU, and Danny Glover, and many of the community and cultural figures that Brenda mentioned.
You know, I want to say this, too, because this is not a spectator sport, as Chris Silvera is fond of telling us, and so right he is. Brothers and sisters, we are pitted against a system in which 1% of the population owns 90% of the wealth. And this is a rank-and-file movement. This is bottom-up. This is the workers who struggle. This is the welfare mothers who don't have. These are the people who are unwaged and unemployed. This is the salt of the earth, as Brenda says. And we need financial help to make this march a reality and to build this movement. And I'm asking you, everyone who listens to this station, everyone who we've enlisted to support Free Speech Radio, everybody who's been mobilized to support Taking Aim to keep this message coming, make this march your own, brothers and sisters. Take responsibility for it. Make your contribution. Call Brenda. Call Chris. Give whatever you can. Contact 5 people that you know and ask them each to contribute $20 and each to take responsibility for getting another 5 to do the same and create a chain letter. Let's get this movement going, not just this march and mobilization, but a march and a mobilization and a movement for our survival. I just want to take a second to cite the super rich Kerry endorsers who appeared at his economic summit in Davenport, Iowa, by way of illuminating who's for us and who is not. Among those coming forward to back John Kerry were David Bonderman, founding partner of the buyout from Texas Pacific Group, the Fort Worth-based financier who made his fortune off the bankruptcies of Continental and American West Airlines involved in a leveraged buyout bid for Enron. He was a prominent backer of George Bush in his first campaign for governor and his first run for the presidency. And indeed, Bonderman said to the Wall Street Journal when he was on his chartered yacht off the coast of Italy, "George is really a good guy personally, but he's not the president we want right now." And there was another man at the Kerry Summit, Owsley Brown, the head of Brown Foreman, the maker of Jack Daniel's whiskey, who told the Wall Street Journal, "Of course, it's not something done lightly for me, a registered Republican all my life. We're just looking for the kind of alternative leadership that Senator Kerry will bring us." And then there was the Bank of America chairman, Charles Gifford, and August A. Bush IV, the president of Anheuser-Busch, and Peter Sherman, second command at Rupert Murdoch's right-wing news corporation, and Jeff Brotman, founder of Costco Wholesale Corporation, with no union workers and sweatshop wages, And then the Texas-based Wyndham Hotel CEO, Fred Kleisner, who gave the strongest financial backing to George Bush in the year 2000. Brothers and sisters, who's there for us? Here's the San Francisco Chronicle on the 12th of September. The speeches of the candidates ignore the U.S. debt disaster. No mention of the fiscal gap, estimated at $72 trillion. That's the headline of the San Francisco Chronicle. It talks about the following, quote, "Whoever wins the 2004 race will become the first United States president to confront what sober-minded experts across the political spectrum describe as an impending fiscal catastrophe lying right around the corner." Chilling is the word U.S. Controller General David Walker used to describe the budget outlook. "The long-term projections are horrifying," added Leonard Berman, co-director of tax policy for the Urban Institute. "I have four children. It really disturbs me. We are heading for a crisis such as we have never seen. $2.3 trillion deficits in every facet, and $40 trillion differential, according to the Government Accountability Office, emerging up to $72 trillion, the San Francisco Chronicle. This is what gives the urgency, the compelling necessity for working people to take responsibility and to set our own agenda and to put forward our demands and hold everyone's feet to the fire. It is a systemic crisis, as Martin Luther King described it 36 years ago. Brothers and sisters, this is not word making. This is not play acting. This is the reality we confront, and we must take responsibility for its transformation. That's the gravamen. That's the thrust. That's the meaning of a Million Worker March mobilization. Brenda Stokely is one of the most compelling and compassionate and eloquent leaders of a mass movement, brothers and sisters. Rally to this leadership. Make it your own. The time is now. And Brenda, would you please address not just the health care demands, but the overall perspective, the overall demands that we make through our articulation of what confronts working people today?
I think our overall demand is that we want to build an independent movement, not just a mobilization. And all of the things that are important to people to live, we want to have a government that is run by and for and in the interest of the majority of the people in this country. And those are the people who work or would work if they were given jobs or allowed to have a society that made sure that everybody was productive in society and everybody could reach their highest potential and capacity in this country. We're really talking about a movement. Those of us who are in organized labor are frustrated to no means when we see people thrown out of jobs and when we try to negotiate a contract with our hands and our feet and our legs tied behind our backs. And that's literally what happens when you're tied to just a legal mode of defending what is right. And only, historically, only the thing that takes place that really resolves things is when people feel their own power and exercise their own power. And that's what this is about. So people need to come out to this, as Ralph said. And it's so important that we have a station like WBAI, because quite frankly, the bourgeois press are dilettantes who ignore working people unless they're killing somebody, killing their family, or killing themselves. Then they're going to cover a working person's tragedy. But they're not going to cover working people on strike. They're not going to cover working people organizing in their workplace to stop an abusive boss. They're not going to cover working people who have been thrown off of their jobs or someone who's been injured, like in North Carolina years ago when this person who owned a chicken processing plant lock people in the plant, so 125 people died, including his own son, and he was sent to jail. They're not going to cover that. So we need, you know, independent media. We need media that recognizes the interests of the majority of people. And we need, more importantly, people to understand you are the historical force that is, will, and can change this country. And everything that you dream that you need, it is only going to happen when in reality you organize and fight for it and not afraid and show your courage. People don't vote because essentially people understand that this is a trick bag. that voting and the electoral arena is a very important arena, but it's only important when I really have a true choice and somebody really is committed for my agenda and comes out of my movement. And that's what people are hoping for, and I'm telling you, you can do it. History tells us we can do it, and we are going to do this. So be there at the march. It's only one step in the direction. It's not the be-all and the end-all, but it's a step. And once you keep on stepping on the right path and going in the right direction, and you're clear of what your goal and your aim is, you're going to make it. We are going to make it.
You've been listening to Brenda Stokely. Brenda is president of AFSCME District Council 1707 in New York. You can meet Brenda and Ralph and Clarence Thomas and Chris Silvera and many other labor folks and community folks, as well as cultural, wonderful cultural presenters, this Friday at a fundraiser for the Million Worker March, 101 Avenue of the Americas. That's SEIU 32J from 6 to 9 p.m. Contact Brenda at the AFSCME office, 212-219-0022. And this is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We'll be with you next week. Meanwhile, you can contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net or takingaim@wbai.org. And if you'd like to listen to the show again or tell your friends about it, visit our archive at www.takingaim.info.
And thank you, Sister Brenda,
Ralph and Maya.
Biki biki no biniye, ta tam ta chila paro ta.